It's been a while since we plugged our Discord channel, but it is the main conduit to the voice of our internet. The all AI chatbots are built with Chris Ying in mind. And if you've been watching our show Dinner Time Live, that's the one way you can connect to the main line of Chris Ying, the voice of the internet. And it's a great way to get some discount codes as well. So you can visit us at majordomomedia.com. There's a link, and there's a discount code for all things Momofuku. You can also pick up the full range of Momofuku products online at shop.momofuku.com. You can also get that 10% code, or you can just go to your local Target, Whole Foods, Kroger, etc., and get your Momofuku chili crunch and your noodles there. But appreciate all the support. And just a friendly reminder that we are live every Tuesday, Netflix, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, for Dinner Time Live with yours truly, David Chang, and the popular voice of the internet, Chris Ying. I just did an interview for Emmy Magazine, and boy, did they want to just interview you.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. They were like, you know, the surprise hit of the show.
Get out of here. Doug.
And that's what I said. I said, shut the fuck up. And again, all episodes of Chrissy and Dave Dine Out are available to stream on Hulu. Also, our growing YouTube channel, which is what, you know?
It's a Majordomo Media. So you just type Majordomo into the YouTube search bar. You'll find it.
What's going on here today?
Low energy promo for the YouTube channel.
And you didn't watch Ying make a ratatouille tartatin.
We did it because you played word association, shouted it into the universe, and then I had to make it.
And let's get on to our show. Welcome to the Dave Chang Show, part of the Ringer Podcast Network, presented by Majordomo Media. Thank you, Yola Tingo, as always. We are in an old Spotify studio. We're joined with producer extraordinaire Corey and somebody that could have been a great NFL player, you know, Lee,
but instead used to play water polo.
I know they could be saying he could have been the Michael Penix with the bad knees and the shoulders, but no. Anyway, we're gonna do a three things, and then we're gonna get into a new segment called Primary Source. Dun, oh, dun, dun.
I like that. Is that you know?
It is me. Thank you guys.
Nice.
Where's the sound effects, dude?
Primary Source.
Let's take a break. This episode is brought to you by Vital Farms. No matter how you like your eggs, scrambled, over easy, or sunny side up, the people at Vital Farms believe in one thing: keeping it bullshit free. That's why their pasture raised eggs come from hens who each have over 108 square feet of space to roam and forage all year round. So you can spend less time questioning your food and more time enjoying it. Look for Vital Farms in your grocery store and learn more at vitalfarms.com. Vital Farms, keeping it bullshit free. This episode is brought to you by Pure Leaf Iced Tea. Great iced tea takes you somewhere else, like new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea that we have here at the Spotify Studios and drink quite a bit, where unexpectedly blackberry flavor transports you to a berry delicious place. So refreshing, you may never want to leave. You will eventually have to, though. But take your time. Try new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. Visit amazon.com/pureleaf and enter 20 Pure Leaf. That's 20 Pure Leaf for 20% off your purchase of new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. You know, wants us to talk about three things, a perfect first course, but I'm not going to answer that. But I will tell you what one of those first courses I think are great, and then three things about that. An oyster is a perfect first course.
Mm.
But there are three things that I fucking hate about getting oysters at places.
Okay.
Hate.
Three mistakes places make.
Mistakes happen all the time. I'll tell you exactly what.
Got it.
Hey, these are Kumamoto. These are, you know, blah, blah, blah bay. These are Rappahannock River, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You're wrong. You got those mixed up. You know what I mean? It's like, no, those aren't Clinton points. These are. I'm not correcting it, but like, I know.
Sure.
You know? But like, Derek just like, I was like,
no, that's none of that.
You literally just said Spanish words to like a completely different language.
Yeah.
Wrong. Two, this has more to do, and we've talked about it before. I hate it when someone, again, blasts all the oysters with lemon juice right off the bat. Yes. Stop.
Yes.
I mean, just don't do that.
It's just rude more than anything else.
I understand it, but I don't. I do think that one of the most perfect foods that nature's ever produced is an oyster, and you get, you know, Poseidon's nectar in its purest form. And I don't like adding anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I want it.
Don't you? Do you think, like, to some degree, the lemon juice, the cocktail sauce, is really for people who don't actually like oysters?
No, that is for, that is the equivalent of people that add 2 packets of sugar and a lot of cream to their coffee.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, I'm not a coffee snob, but when it comes to oyster, I'm fucking snob number one, motherfucker. So
can we return to the first thing, though? When they come out and they say Kumamoto's, Hog Island Sweetwater's, Beausoleil, whatever, regardless if they get that right or not, is there an order in which you're approaching the varietals?
No, like, I want to go East Coast to West Coast if it is the double. And if it is just West Coast, I want to go least creamy to most metallic.
Start with least creamy?
Yeah, like creamy, melon-like to the most iron, okay, metallic-like.
So you would go Kumamoto first if you had like a plate of oysters there, and then proceed to the more sort of briny metallic.
Yeah, but I mean, I think I'd probably have to say, if it was just a Sophie's Choice, I'd fucking kill all West Coast oysters. Like, if I had a Thanos snap, I'd be like, got to choose.
That's what you would
spend. East Coast of Pittsburgh represent. East Coast, even though Pittsburgh's not East Coast.
The snap, the Thanos, yeah, snap almost killed Thanos, the, yeah, most powerful.
So I don't have to listen to no bullshit from a server being like, it's got this melon-like brine, and it smells like watermelon. No, we can just kill that right then and there.
All right, so incorrectly identifying the oysters, faux pas number one. Faux pas number two, immediately housing everything with lemon juice or whatever.
Then also, there's just the things. Like, I'm not a fan of putting the oyster shell back.
Upside down. Under the tray.
You keep it. You got to keep your bones. You got to know. How do you count? You got to count. Who does what? Because somebody inevitably is going to have, if there's four of us, somebody's going to eat more than the other, and not me. At least when it comes to oysters, I'm very equitable.
But isn't that an argument for putting them back so I can mask how many I've had?
I think that, like, you should put them on your plate and let the world know what a fucking slob you are. All right?
I agree with, I think there's, like, something weirdly unhygienic about it, too. I've just put this in my mouth.
Yeah, and I'm putting it down. Just, yeah, no.
Like, there's been one or two occasions in my life where I have been sharing a communal plate of chicken wings and seen somebody try to put the spent bone on, like, the other side of the same communal plate, like on the other side of the sauces. I'm just like, dude,
I don't know people like that. Just like I hope that I don't know people that, like, you know,
it's wrong. It's
wrong. Do terrible things to children, you know?
It's right up there. It's a similar crime.
And the last one in oyster etiquette, it really comes from the kitchen. And this is something that I feel like most kitchens don't do. And it's something that I've been yelled at and I've learned the right way. And even though it's probably inconsequential, the physiology of an oyster means that there's only one abductor muscle. And it's always, nature has put it on the right side. There's no left-sided abductor muscle. And if it is, I wouldn't eat it.
It's a mutant.
It's a mutant. That's
an X-Men.
That's just fucking weird.
It don't belong there.
Right? So if it's always on the right side, then why does my oyster look like that it grew from the left side? That's because somebody flipped it, because they opened it like a jackass. And I think a lot of people think flipping an oyster so you can hide the belly, basically you just, you know, destroyed.
Yeah, you mangled it and then you flipped it over to hide.
Which I think is the most common practice. I don't think people realize it, honestly. I don't think it matters too much. But that's not, there's an art to oyster shucking, and that's not it.
Right.
And when you flip it over, you know, that's like saying you are a world-class soccer player, but you play in an American soccer league that's not the MLS.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. So it doesn't, but this is purely this is high level shit you're talking about.
It's not high level shit. It's called fucking do it right.
No. The art of it, but I'm saying the preference that you're expressing right now doesn't really affect the average person's experience of eating the oyster.
It affects mine.
It affects yours because you think it got opened by an amateur.
I don't know. I mean, you can tell a lot. You can tell a lot. You can tell a lot about how someone opens an oyster, right? If done well, and if they've properly separated it, if they've taken the time to take even like a paintbrush. I learned that from Andrew McConnell at Cumulus years ago in Australia. When I saw that, I was like, oh, fuck, I'm stealing that. They have paintbrushes on their station, so they're not washing it out. You never want to introduce water. And they just, because inevitably, if you open it, you're going to get some detritus and sediment or something. You want
to
just
use the paintbrush to flick the shell. Yeah,
we do that. Yeah, awesome. It's great. So it's like you want to save all of that, right? And I do think it matters when you pop the belly because you do get some different flavors. You know, it's encapsulated in and of itself. And when you pop it, you definitely get a muddling of flavors. That's ever, ever so minute. But more importantly, it's like, do it right. You know, and it happens sometimes, right? But that also means you're not shucking oysters properly. And even on an oyster knife, you can keep one side sharp. So when you can cut off the muscle itself, et cetera, et cetera. So these are all the things. So when I look at a perfect course, I believe what oyster is. I also do like a prepared oyster course, right? And they can be fantastic. Really can be. But more often than not, it's like I'd rather have it just plain. And another thing is don't give me big oysters.
Yeah.
Don't give me that big log of phlegm.
It's so much.
And I don't want big, big bellones, and I don't want the big ones that are like the size of a shack shoe.
So let me ask you this.
It's fucking gross.
If grilled, they can be bigger. Like a grilled oyster or whatever, a cooked oyster.
Fine. Grilled oysters are great too. But again, like no offense to oysters south of Pittsburgh. Not a big fan. Warm water oyster is not my thing.
Hey, let me ask you this in the interest of this, of primary sources and getting real answers to things. So can you explain, the way in which every restaurant that serves oysters has to keep the tags, right?
Correct.
And these are like date tags and source tags in case somebody gets foodborne illness, toxic shock, whatever, like you can trace it back to specific, that's the purpose of these tags. Is there a rule or a law or anything of like oysters are only allowed to be served X number of days after delivery or anything like that? Or what does a restaurant
You could keep oysters alive for a while with a filtration system.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is it's like you want to use them as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
You know what I avoid? Happy hour oyster for 50 cents. I avoid those. That's not a bat sign. Like, I gotta fucking go there.
I mean, I do too. I do too. I avoid the places that serve, you know, oysters by the hundreds or whatever. But is that because in your mind, you're thinking like they're getting from poor quality?
One caveat with the southern oysters, they are good, delicious, grilled. They're hot. Mm-hmm. I eat them hot. Or in soups and stews.
Yeah.
But not cold.
Or like an oyster or under the burlap sack and stuff.
Yeah.
But you would avoid all situations where it's like a 50-cent oyster.
Well, I'd wait. Like, I would do this if, like, I would treat it like finding a new drug dealer. You do it first.
Hey, Ching, you want to get oysters or 50 cents right now?
You go first. Yeah. I'll go next week.
I'll come back next week if you're still alive. Yeah, there is something. There's something about the 50 cent living animal I'm going to eat that doesn't feel right.
Well, again, I'd like to argue that an oyster is vegetarian or vegan.
Oyster is because it has no sentience.
Non-sentient.
I mean, I don't know. Can you?
I got to make a vegan menu this weekend for Dinner Time Live, and maybe I'm going to just do that. Be like, well, here's a big old 12 ounce steamed oyster with fish sauce. Ginger scallion.
I mean, a fish steamed. But like a giant.
Big old foot of an oyster.
Can you imagine? Here's a vegan. Here's a foot long oyster.
I mean, for those that don't know, in a lot of Cantonese restaurants, they want the big fucking 25-year-old oyster.
Yeah.
You know?
They want a big one.
And it literally is the size of Shaq's shoe. It's like 23 inches.
Yeah.
And it's not Not nice.
I do always feel weird. I remember going to, at Noma, they serve like the mahogany clam, and they're like, these can be 150 years old. And I'm just like, well, I don't want to eat it then. I don't want to be the one to eat the thing.
I did. I loved eating that. I was like, I just tasted World War II.
Like, that's crazy, though, right? When you eat something that's it's like, old.
I just tasted the first transatlantic passage.
This clam is older than America. Like, yeah. I was like, it's so insane. Yeah, I avoid the 50 cent oyster, too. I'm with you.
All right. Let's take a break. We're coming back with Katie Flannery. This episode is brought to you by Vital Farms. No matter how you like your eggs, scrambled, over easy, or sunny side up, the people at Vital Farms believe in one thing, keeping it bullshit free. That's why their pasture-raised eggs come from hens who each have over 108 square feet of space to roam and forage all year round. So you can spend less time questioning your food and more time enjoying it. Look for Vital Farms in your grocery store and learn more at vitalfarms.com. Vital Farms, keeping it bullshit free.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Today's guest is Katie Flannery, the Chief Operating Officer at Flannery Beef in San Rafael, California. We've used their awesome beef in the past. Katie is a third-generation butcher following her father, Brian, and her grandfather, Brian Sr., who founded Brian's Quality Meats within an independent grocery store in 1963. Welcome. Welcome
Thank you.
To the show.
Happy to be here.
nice to see you.
A new segment, Primal Source.
Primary.
Oh, that's a new segment.
Primary. It's a primary source. But Katie, we brought you on because Dave said the other day he was sort of he's been more interested recently. He's been experiencing, you know, some health things. Just trying to live healthier.
Time to make a change.
And he was like, I just need to eat good quality. You refer to it as clean protein.
Well, let's just put it aside. There's stuff you can buy as a citizen, as a unlisted culinary officer.
An average Joe.
Average Joe.
Yes.
Versus getting the best shit possible, like single utter butter stuff.
It's different. It's different what consumers can buy than pros.
It's like, no, I don't want that pork because... Yeah, I want the pork that sleeps on the other side. You know, that's how detailed it can get when you work with farmers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big difference mm-hmm. when you go to the supermarket. Katie, when you buy groceries, as I'm sure you do at a grocery store, do you ever buy beef at the grocery store?
Never.
Never.
No, I do not. No, I don't.
Is it because
it's yucky?
Is it because you don't need to or because you wouldn't?
It's probably half and half, to be honest. One, I don't need to. Pretty much we've got everything, you know, here that I could want to be cooking at home.
Must be nice.
I recognize I am very blessed in that regard. The other reason why, you know, if I'm going to a grocery store, I wouldn't buy beef. I think grocery stores are nice. It's like a one-stop shop. You can get everything you need. But the meat that, for the most part, in grocery stores, once it gets there, you really don't have much traceability from, you know, where it came from, right? It's just in their counter. If it's packaged, if they don't have butchers that are actually like breaking down meat, it's probably, you know, was packaged somewhere else, sent to them. They just put it in the counter. And so again, you don't really know where it came from, what you're getting, and the quality can be iffy. That said, you know what? Actually, I have gotten a couple steaks from Costco before. Costco sometimes has really good stuff.
Hey,
we just bought a bunch of Costco beef for Dinner Time Live. So Flannery obviously supplies to a lot of very nice restaurants, very excellent restaurants. You do a robust online business. Dave was starting with just like the very most basic idea of like, I'm an average Joe, I'm a consumer, and I go on the internet, and I'm like, I want to buy some good meat. Good meaning.
I just read some Esquire.com article, and they're like, Joe Rogan says I got to eat a carnivore diet using grass-fed regenerative beef.
If Joe Rogan says
Andrew Huberman said that I'll get married if I have, you know, this amount of protein.
I'll blow my T levels straight out my ass if I can eat some more beef, whatever it is.
As I look at daylight at 7 a.m.
If I can eat a hamburger from my ice plunge bath in the morning, I'll live 150 years. Do you agree with this idea though? Like, if I'm the average person logging on, like, I have no idea what I'm really getting. There's so many places selling meat. There's so many buzzwords. It's hard.
Can I give the equivalent of what it feels like, Katie, when I go down this road of trying to find and procure higher quality proteins? It's like when I land in a foreign country and they're like, taxi? taxi? You know, like,
A million people trying to flag you down.
Just tell me, like, hotel?
Right. And if you say yes to any of them, you will wake up without a kidney. Like that's like
what that's it what it feels like. It's a dangerous booby led trap where I'm like, I don't know, and I feel like a sucker in a room if I say yes to any
that
of this
is a,
stuff.
That's a great analogy, I think. But like, is that the case, right? Like, it
if
is
you go online, confusing. Yeah, yeah, no. If you go online, it's absolutely like that. Hopefully, you keep your kidneys though. I'd probably start by saying like, what's your definition of good? Though, when you say, you know, if I'm looking for good meat, are you looking for, you know, is your definition of good something that's going to be leaner because you're looking to cut fat out of your diet? Or are you looking for something that's incredibly tender, you know, a steak that you can cut with a fork? How are you going to be cooking it, right? If you're going to do low and slow, that's going to open you up to a bunch of different cuts that you wouldn't necessarily do like on a grill. So that's, I think, part of the problem is I think a lot of people want like a really black and white answer, right? This is what you should get if you want good meat. But there's so much more to that I don't think you can get a black and white answer.
Well, I would think probably the first sort of filter, right, when you're purchasing meat, whether it's at a store, Costco, or online, is organic or non-organic, right? Are there some farms that are independent, that are quote non-organic, that are way better quality than the quote unquote organic?
Oh, hell yeah.
Ones, right? Absolutely. I don't think people understand
1,000%,
that.
So how is that possible? If organic is the highest of standards and this farm is saying I'm not organic, how can
organic
that be
isn't the highest of standards. It's a marketing term.
Highest label, right? So how can that be?
Yeah.
How can that be?
I'll give you like a really great example. A long time ago, probably 8 years ago, we were working with a gal out of Montana who was raising her own Wagyu. And I mean, she had really, really high genetics on these. So I mean, these were about as close to, you know, Japanese as you could get. Her farm was phenomenal. She had 100,000 acres up in Montana. These things were free roaming. Amazing. Awesome. She wanted to get the organic label. So you do have to go through the USDA to get that certification. They came out, inspected the ranch and said, well, we can't give you organic until you replace every single one of your fence posts because they've been treated with creosote and that's not acceptable. And so she said, who's going to pay for me to replace 100,000 acres of fence posts just for me to get that organic label? And so ultimately she said, it's just not worth it. So that's sometimes what you can run into.
And then, but for that meat to go to market, it's not going to be at the premium price that she could fetch, because organic to me is the great filter decider for people when they decide, oh, this is what I'm going to get and this is better. Because when they buy it, there's no way you know where the provenance is for the most part. You have no idea if it's from Montana or California. You have no idea about any of this stuff. So I think for me, as trying to take off a professional chef's hat, I can see this as a really just slippery slope of, well, organic's got to be better. I think first and foremost, it's probably not. there are situations where non-organic is certainly better than a quote-unquote organic, and you don't even have to do that in beef. You can do that in, you go to the farmer's market and you talk to a farmer that's like, yeah, you know, they're just like, I'm not going to fucking deal with the USDA bullshit and get the bullshit stamp of organic or not. That's a whole nother conversation that we're never going to, I think, fit here today. I think the other question then is, I guess probably the next level is prime choice versus
select.
Right.
Can you give us give us like the brief overview of what that means?
Standard. Yeah, of course. Well, and then also to start, you don't have to grade your animals. I think a lot of people get thrown by that. So there is a section of the
How else will I know if I love them?
There's no such thing as unconditional love here.
Okay.
All our cows have to be prime or else.
What about prime?
We're going to disown them.
What about prime minus? No.
That's funny for nobody.
There are levels within each grade, though, too, if you do want to go down that plus what? Minus.
Is that true? Yes? I didn't know I did that. That's true. Is that true?
There's prime plus?
Yeah. Choice. Well, it's not actually called like plus, but prime is, there's like levels within it. Choice has a much wider range of levels. You can have like lower choice and higher choice.
Well, that's
that's huge. Really like wait, lay down no.
When I go to, I never see these grades.
How do I know?
Like the upper choice stuff goes to restaurants. To your earlier point, you know, the chefs are getting the cream of the crop.
So how wide is that range of choice? So if I go and I buy, if a restaurant's getting the high choice and I'm buying choice from like a discount store, like how wide is that range of quality?
It's hard to say because that you can find some choice that technically wouldn't be called an upper choice, but it is freaking gorgeous. And so it's for the grading aspect, I would say visual. You as the consumer, you can pick up what a higher quality piece is if you're just looking at the marbling in the meat. More marbling is going to be a higher grade. Bulk of beef, oh, for sure. If you know what you're looking for, and that's why I say Costco, because they have all their steaks laid out and you can cherry pick at Costco.
Katie, can I tell you what I like to do at Costco? Sometimes I'll be looking at, say, you know, let's just say they're sirloins or strip loins or something. Or a tri-tip. I like cooking tri-tip now that I'm in California.
Santa Maria.
Yeah, right?
Right? And I'm looking and, you know, there's choice and there's prime tri-tip right next to each other. And I see something in the choice section where I'm like, that looks nice. I can see that the marbling may have escaped the USDA regulators purview. And I'm like hoping that the woman holding the choice is going to put it down because it's not prime. And they drop it and I immediately push out of the way and I pick it up and I put it in my container because I'm looking for the marbling because I know that it's sometimes just like a not a random thing, but it's not always accurate. Right. There are better. I want marbling.
Well, you know what they do at the slaughterhouse, how they determine the grade of a carcass is they'll make a cut on the ribs of the animal and they'll basically look at like an eye, the eye of the rib. And it's from that window that then they'll say this entire carcass is prime. This is choice. And sometimes it can be wrong. You could have a really weak eye, but other muscles are incredibly marbled. Because again, you know, at the end of the day, we're working with what were once live creatures. You know, nothing is perfect.
And some of those cows skip leg day, and some didn't. So I mean, this is really interesting because if you go to the Flannery Beef website, there's like this beautiful story about your father going with your grandfather when they first opened the butcher shop to go select sides of beef when you could still go there. You go and the butchers would pick which ones they wanted to bring back to the shop. I was doing some browsing on some of these sort of online sites where you can order beef. And frequently you see like hand-selected steaks, right? Like that's like a buzzword you get on these things. Does that mean anything?
No, that's bullshit. I've done it. I think I have used something like that, like, you know, hand cut to perfection. Like, well, how else would it get cut? You know, but like, it sounds cool. But that's
that's no different than a restaurant saying we sell fresh vegetables. Right.
Like, yeah.
What else you fucking do?
But that's not a thing anymore, right? Like at this point in the world, butchers aren't going and like choosing their sides really. And they're not able to do that.
You really can't
as much, right? Like you can order from the producers you like, you can order from the farmers you like, and hope for the best, but you're not, there's no hand selecting happening there, nor is there.
No, they're not going to let you, you know, stop the process, you know, basically walk down the line of carcasses and just say, well, I want this one and that one, but not this one. It's just, it disrupts the whole flow of everything for the larger producers. Okay. So, you know, they tell you to go pound sand if you ask for that.
Katie, so for an audience member that's trying to, I can just imagine, like, well, they're not talking about the marbling.
In Dave's head, there's always a voice of an audience member complaining.
but they just glossed over the difference. Marbling. What constitutes a prime grade for marbling on beef? What are you looking for?
You're looking for a higher amount of intramuscular fat. So that's going to be the fat within the muscle itself, not kind of on the exterior of some muscles. Like if you think of a New York, like a strip loin, for example, it's got, you know, the eye of meat and there is a big band of fat running on the exterior. So don't think, okay, the bigger the fat on the exterior of that piece, the better it is. You're looking for the little tiny pinpricks of fat within the muscle itself. Because basically more marbling, more intramuscular meat, what that's going to do for you as the consumer is two things. It's going to add flavor, fat is flavor, and it's going to add tenderness. Because if you think of muscle as like one solid block, every single pinprick of fat is breaking that up. It's making it a more tender product.
So to the point of what you guys were just talking about, going to Costco, perusing the steak refrigerator section, looking for one with more marbling, when a USDA grader is examining and grading the beef, is he or she just doing it by eye? Or is there like a test to it? Are they actually weighing fat versus anything?
No, they're just getting this cross-section in the rib.
And they're just looking at it and saying that's prime or not, right?
Used to be that they were just looking at it. Now we've got technology. There's a computer that actually will scan it and they will spit out, you know, a numerical value. They'll actually
win above replacement.
ChatGPT, man.
Yes. modern times.
That's but it is mostly a visual indicator. So I'm saying when you guys go to Costco or we go to Costco and we look at the steaks, you're doing the same thing. You're looking, it's like you said, it's a living animal. You can find a better cut if you just look.
If you look. Yeah.
And we're just trying to give people the information so they know what to look for.
Yeah.
And basically it's this. If you see, I think, good the marbling, right? If it's like woven throughout the muscle tissue, at least USDA grade, that is grain fed, when it's more lattice-like, that's going to be more prime.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I found that, you know, certain things that I'll buy choice, like if I'm buying a chuck roast or something that's I'm going to boil the shit out of, I don't need, you know, marbling. It's always why it's funny. It's like Wagyu cuts. I was like, no, you don't need it to be marbled. There's certain cuts you don't. There's certain cuts in steak that you definitely do. But I think it's interesting that people may not know the difference in marbling with the different genetics of cows and the difference in their diet, right?
Mm.
Yeah. Do you think that's a next level that people are going to be able to get?
I think people are starting to kind of realize that, that different breeds will have different characteristics. We actually see it a lot because we're somewhat unique in the breed that we use. We like Holstein. And so Holstein is the dairy breed. Like I think it's like 70 or 80% of all dairy produced in the United States comes from Holstein cows. But then there is the other side of that coin. What happens to the males, right? They're not going to go into milk production.
That's a long running conversation I had with a woman that started Ayrshire Farms. She was trying to produce sustainable veal.
Mm.
And this is an interesting conversation for people that care about sustainability and sort of animal welfare. You could argue that it's better to actually sell veal from a male Holstein cow than it is to like let them roam about because they lost the genetic. Nobody's lost the genetic lotto more than a male Holstein cow.
Well, see, I disagree. I think that's perception. That is honest to God perception, because what people in the industry have found out within like, you know, a relative recent time frame is that they have a totally different feed requirement. Holsteins are not feed efficient, meaning if you raise an Angus and a Holstein the same way, the Angus is going to outperform the Holstein by far, right? But if you feed your Holstein a very high energy diet, it will marble like crazy. And so that was the shift that had to happen. There's still a lot of people in my dad's generation that, you know, if you say we've got Holstein, they just say, well, that's the worst beef I've ever had in my entire life. How are you selling Holstein? But that's because if you don't feed it right, it is very, very poor quality. But the Holstein's genetic ability to marble, to put on fantastic marbling on the right diet is amazing.
But the right diet is everything.
High energy.
Right?
High energy.
When you say high energy, you mean like Celsius and like Red Bulls? What are we talking about? What's like a high energy diet for a cow?
Basically, and it was funny, a long time ago, Dad and I went to some like agricultural show out at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're connecting with a gal who's got a PhD in rumen nutrition, which was like crazy, ruminant nutrition. And she was saying, don't think of food as food, think of food as energy, because different foods are going to have different energy levels. And so that's why people love the concept of corn-fed beef. Corn, all carbohydrates, super, super high in energy. That's what's going to allow the animals to develop that intramuscular fat, the marbling.
So
if you compare that to grass-fed, that's why grass-fed beef usually is on the leaner side. There's not enough energy in grass to get that marbling.
Too much photosynthesis.
It's too hard to make the energy.
But going back to the Holstein cow, I think years ago when I first met Magnus Nilsson, the great chef, when he had Favakin in northern Sweden, before I met him, he was on my radar because like this crazy chef is basically fermenting. You know, he's wrapping whole sides of Holstein cows, old dairy cows, and capping them in beef sweat and letting them just age for like a year plus. And the smell was just out of control. But it turned into something completely different and flavorful. And I don't know if the diet was high energy or not, but there are ways. And I think that was a seminal moment for, I think, a lot of people in the fancy food world to realize like, oh, all of these things that people said that were traditionally terrible, if you change the technique a little bit, you can get something really fabulous, right? So
it's only terrible if you expect to serve it in the typical way. Like you just slice it and throw it on the grill and it's done.
And right? I think that was the first time I tried your beef, your family's beef, was the Holstein, the male Holstein cow as well. And that was delicious. And I was like, oh, this is cool, right? This is happening. Can we talk a little bit about the marbling difference? And I did say ooh and ah about grain fed. And I do. It's like I clearly Big Boy Asian Club, you know, prerequisites, you have to have a lot of calories consumed from grain-fed diet. There's something about beef, American beef, when they're finished off on grain, that give it a flavor, fat balance that I don't think nobody else has in the world, right?
I would agree. Yeah.
It's like NASCAR.
is it a flavor like that we are just used to because we are so used to grain fed to corn fed beef?
It's the best blend. It's the best blend for burgers.
Uh-huh.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
That's why American burgers are better.
So when people seek out grass fed, it's more for the sustainability than it is for flavor.
You know, it's going to be a totally different flavor profile. Personally, I'm not a fan of it, but some people are. So I'm not going to say that nobody wants to eat grass-fed for the flavor. There are people that enjoy that. It's going to be, I mean, just because it's not as fatty as a grain-fed, totally different flavor profile.
Again, this is just my experience, Katie. I didn't understand grass-fed till I got to South America for the first time, right? And I was like, oh, this tastes good. Because my experience eating grass-fed beef in America was like, it tasted like I was eating tofurkey or something like that. It just didn't taste good.
What was happening differently?
Well, I think it has to do with genetics as well and the breed of cow and the climate. Like a lot of these grass-fed cows that were being raised, or at least when I was tasting them in America, they're in the wrong climate. Right.
It's like a polar bear at the zoo.
No, it plays a part.
It plays a huge part because I was like, and when I was in Brazil and Argentina, I was like, why is the fucking beef here? It's not just because I'm there. I was like, it is legitimately more delicious as a grass fed. And I was told that it was because like, this is where these cows originated. This is the diet that they, this is their habitat for the most part. And this is what they do. And the one reason I've never always loved grass fed was the marbling on it is always more not distributed, right, Katie? It's like, it's much more of a fat band than like a lightning strike. You know what I mean? Like, and well marbled is like a beautiful like shot of lightning that is spread out everywhere. And
it's like
grass,
the Milky Way.
Yeah, the Milky Way. And grass fed is like you just stuck a piece of gum.
Right. You like inserted cloves of fat into it.
Exactly. Cloves of fat into it. And I've just, it's just never, but I've had, when I got there to South America, I did see grass fed that was much more well marbled and I enjoyed it. But like, you know, one of the things I'm going back to this idea though of grass fed is it's not just the Hubermans and the fucking, you know,
The Rogans
of the world promoting this. You know, it's like the idea of eating regenerative beef or beef that or protein that is grass fed in America, whether it's bison or whatever, that's the more ideal meat. Like bison, for example, not that we're talking about bison, but it has all the omega-3s, etc. This is just the science of it all. And like my doctor's like, you got to eat more grass fed. All the doctors are like, you got to eat more grass fed beef. And I'm like,
but I don't want to.
But like, where the fuck do you buy grass-fed beef? You know, that you can vouch for because it's not something that restaurants serve too much of, grass-fed.
And how, and yeah, so where can you do that, Katie? And then how, I just want to, grass-fed as another term. Like, how accurate is that term as a descriptor for beef if I say it's grass-fed? Is that a certain USDA standard? Is there anything to that?
No, that's going to be pretty accurate. I mean, I know what some places are doing, going back to this concept of like energy in food. Grass has the most energy when it's new growth, right? And so you will have some places that will harvest all of their grass when it has the highest amount of energy. And then that's what they will feed to the animals over the course of their lifetime. So conceptually, it's not the same as the animal is only on pasture for the entire life eating what comes up out of the ground. But it is like the diet is only grass.
Okay. But that was it. That's something I hadn't thought of either, though, is a grass-fed cow, if it says grass-fed, it doesn't necessarily mean this cow was wandering the pastures of 100,000 acres beautifully walking around and eating grass, right? It can also just mean it stood there in a room and was given bales.
That
grass, too,
but right? I think you can tell if it's been walking around by the color of the fat and the marbling of the fat as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just me. But again, I've seen a lot of beef, as she's seen way more beef than I have. Mm.
And then I want to ask you to Dave's point of like the Argentinian cow growing where it belongs, the Brazilian, the South American cow. What is your take on the like the American Wagyu in general?
Oh, I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's like a little bit like the wild, wild west, because people have kind of come to think of Wagyu as absolute top quality, but Wagyu is just the breed, right? And I want to say, I forget if it was the 70s or the 80s, Japan brought over a couple bulls into the United States. It's a Japanese breed. And then at some point, though, they declared Wagyu a national treasure. So they don't export genetics anymore. So the Wagyu that exists in the United States, everything has to come kind of from their genetics. And so you have to crossbreed other animals with these to, you know, keep from getting inbred animals. So when you say Wagyu, it could be a 25% by genetics Wagyu, 75% Angus. It could be 50%. It could be 75%. And the more Wagyu genetics the animal has, the higher the quality will be. But I don't think that your average Joe kind of knows that. And so they'll just assume, okay, well, if I'm getting Wagyu, it's got to be amazing. But, you know, I've seen Wagyu come through that's, I wouldn't even grade it choice because it's just a very low genetic Wagyu.
So it's like every person who is a descendant of Genghis Khan being like, I'm a Khan, basically.
But also there's nature versus nurture here too. And having been to a lot of these farms, I would say I've been to a lot of proper Wagyu farms throughout Japan. And I can't imagine people in America raising their Wagyu crossbreeds the same way they're raising. It's just a different world altogether, right? Like, yeah, I would say that, like, you know, Japanese beef, you're not moving too much. You know, it's like a real indoorsman lifestyle. You are really chilling out,
right?
Eating well.
So you're saying like it's not
high energy
just
diet.
It's not just the genetic. It's buying a Ferrari and giving it regular fuel and storing it outside.
Yeah, you don't get that fat. I mean, if you put the Miyazaki beef on a free range, like there's just not enough land for it to happen, right? To be pasture raised. I think if you did, you would have it would be one of those like social media before and after transformations of a cow. You know, it's like
just a weight loss.
Yeah, it's like, dude, it's like the opposite of the carnivore diet.
You're that same Miyazaki cow. You drink so much weight. Yeah,
fat content is going to change dramatically.
Are you on Ozempic? Yeah. You look great.
Yeah. Don't want to talk about Wagyu too much, but what do we do? If somebody wants to buy grass fed beef, how does one find that?
Gosh, if you can kind of buy in bulk, I'd probably say look for like independent ranchers. Because a lot of, you know, the age of the internet, a lot of people are having more success at selling online. And so you can find a local, you know, maybe not local to you, local somewhere else, rancher who's doing a good job raising a grass-fed animal and has an e-commerce store and buy from them. A lot of people that are doing it themselves, though, trying to raise the animals and sell them, they will tend to do like cattle packs where you have to get a set amount. Because when you move whole animal, you know, in the real world, everybody only wants to order ribeyes and fillets. But there's a lot of other stuff that they need to move. So they'll basically say, okay, you can get some ribeyes, but you're also going to take a chuck roast. You're also going to take some sirloin. You're going to take a lot of ground beef. But that would be one way to really know exactly where you're getting it from.
What about these bigger like companies that do the subscription model? Are they buying from good farms? Are they legitimate? Or are they just like, can I trust that they're doing the homework for me?
I wouldn't, but I'm a negative Nancy by nature.
No. That's another name for this podcast.
Negative Nancy by nature is a really good name for a segment.
it's tough because how do you know? Especially if you are doing the world of e-commerce. For me personally, but this is a luxury that I have being in the industry, I like buying from places that I have physically gone to the establishment. You know, I've seen their animals. I've walked the floor at the slaughterhouse. You know, I've seen it all. So I know I can trust them.
Don't you feel that, Katie, that every single human being, every U.S. citizen should walk the floor of a slaughterhouse? Seriously.
Yeah, I do. I really, really do.
I really think
people have gotten disconnected from, you know, where meat comes from.
Because it's fucking crazy.
It is insane. It is, it's an so experience. Fucking crazy.
But it's important to know and like to make that choice to be, I'm going to continue to eat or I'm going to make smarter choices or like I'm more invested in the types of animals I eat once you see it, once you know it.
It's just never going
to
happen.
You also want to see that, I mean, again, I like to know that where the animals are getting slaughtered, they're putting as much care as you can into this process. I mean, we all know what's happening at the end of the day, but you know, you can see if somebody's doing it right versus if somebody is doing it sloppy.
And you don't want to stress out the cow.
That's a legitimate, there's like an economic reason for that. It's called a dark cutter. If the animal gets super, super stressed at the time of slaughter, they get like a rush of adrenaline.
Lactic acid.
And the meat, mm-hmm. Is that what it is? The meat will actually turn dark, dark red. And so visually, they can't sell it because it's got this like discoloration to it. So a lot of slaughterhouses have implemented, like they put a lot of money and research into basically like the chute, how the animals get to, you know, the point of slaughter I know one of the ones that we work with, they had Temple Grandin design, you know, their whole slaughterhouse entry, basically like so that the cows are walking uphill and not in a straight line. They're wandering. So it kind of keeps them calm before that point.
Before we let you go, I know so you've helped us with a few of the sort of marketing terms and grades of things. Can I throw a few more that I saw out there and you tell me if they're real or bullshit? I mean, I don't want to get into dry age, wet age. We can maybe talk about that separately. But natural, if it says natural, does that mean something or not?
No. Nothing. It means it's an animal is a natural creature. It's everything like it's natural.
That's yeah, not
that, that
any
one
indication.
That one is crazy.
Okay.
No, I think the USDA says that if you're going to call something natural, it means that it's been minimally processed. But like again, what does that mean? So no, natural, I would not pay any regard to that.
Before that, one thing we should ask is when you were saying buying from a smaller farm, does an audience member understand what they're going to get when they get a side, a quarter?
No.
How much is that? Yeah, this is a good point. Because I actually, you I have
need
a friend.
If you have a deep freezer, you need a deep freezer in the garage if you're going to go that route.
Like, yeah, I have a friend who sells like sides like that. So if I buy a side, how much meat am I ordering?
Half a cow.
I mean, you'd probably, I don't know, maybe like a 250, deep freezer's worth. 250 pounds, give or take.
Okay.
and a lot of it's going to be burger.
Right. Well, you could go
if you've got a family, though. I mean, you can, and
or you
can
go in with friends, right? You can go in and say, like, let's order a side of cow. You know, we'll, I've done this, I've divvied it up with friends, and it works. Sort of.
It's too much work for
it. It's so much work. And then you become a distributor. Then you become like, I got to distribute this beef to people and do deliveries. It's a nightmare.
What are you stepping the beef with to maximize your profits?
they're all packaged in lead coated plastic. So just I saw another thing that was describing things as gold grade. Is that anything?
That's a Snake River thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's just, does that mean anything though?
Yeah. That's kind of like their own internal, I think, classification.
Can I ask one time? I don't want to say who, but it was like a real clever marketing trick because they were like, this beef that everyone's buying isn't from a farm, but it was processed at a place that was called a farm.
Processed in a facility once visited by a farmer.
So they're not lying.
It's technically a farm, but it is not a farm.
But that type of shit happens all the time, Katie, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
It's not even based on a true story. It was like, I'm a theoretical physicist.
Do you put
it? I washed off a knife. That's basically what it is.
Certified by a man who watched Oppenheimer. Do you, I mean, Shane, this is for you too. Like, what do you think when you see the term wet aged?
No.
Just no.
No, I mean, like, can you explain?
Yeah. I'll try to do it as quickly as I can. Wet aging, it's technically it's a yes and a no. All right. For the longest time, Dad always said wet aging is bullshit. But it turns out, so wet aging basically means that after the animal is slaughtered, the subprimals, the kind of, you know, muscle groups are vacuum sealed. All right. So they're packaged in plastic. There's no oxygen in that packaging. Once they're packaged like that, they are now wet aging. And so you can leave them in that cryovac bag for, you know, a week, a month, however long you want. What happens in that package is a slight tenderization of the product because it's basically, it's a controlled decay, right? The animal has been slaughtered. You now have enzymes within the meat that are essentially like breaking down the molecular bonds, okay? But that only happens, that tenderization only happens for about 30 days or so. Then those enzymes die. So if you've ever had somebody try to pitch you, well, 120-day wet aged, it's bullshit. It's going to be no different than after those 30 days. So that's why I say it's like, it's a yes and a no. You do get some benefit from about a month of wet aging, but it's, you know,
but the,
not
the
a,
cuts
I think
that
people use it as a gimmick. Katie,
aren't there cuts that like are wet age? Like if I get oxtails, it doesn't fucking matter. You know what I mean? Like to me, it's,
oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. Wet aging is never going to turn an oxtail into a fillet.
Exactly.
If it's a tougher cut, wet age till the cows come home. That was a bad pun, but you know, it's not going to do anything.
That's what I look at. If I got to make roast beef or something, like I don't, you know, mm-hmm. to me, it's inconsequential.
And then
the other thing to keep in mind, though, is that like, unless you're literally like slaughtering in your backyard, everything you get will be wet aged to some extent, right? Like, it's going to leave the slaughterhouse in a cryovac package. It's wet aging while it's on the truck to Costco.
I'm wet aging it in my refrigerator for 3 days before I serve it. What? So, question about dry aging then for both of you. Is just the longer always the better?
Everything has its moment of sweet spot.
Right. So, like, if it, to your point, Katie, if I'm just like, this is a 240-day dry age, whatever, like, doesn't just mean automatically this is going to be the greatest.
Let's say, are you a YouTuber? What did you baste it in Jack Daniels and molasses and MSG?
Peanut butter.
Yeah.
Oh, peanut butter for sure. My peanut butter wet aged steak.
Which is better? The $1 steak or this 600-day aged?
I hate that so much. If somebody goes to Flannery Beef's website and wants to order something right now, what are you liking right now? What are you eating right now? What's the cut? What's the move right now?
Oh, I'm ribeye all day, every day. It's gonna have a little bit more fat to it, but that's where the flavor is.
I'm a ribeye. I do like my chuck. There's so much you can get in a 7-bone.
Mm-hmm. But as a steak cut, you're a ribeye man.
In general, but I'm sure Katie's the same too. I'm like the equivalent of some like weird music person that's like, no, I need that.
You're the orange wine of beef.
Yeah, well, yeah, little, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, funky. Oh, I need a little bit of
juice. I need a Zabuton.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, here's one though. Dave's been asking this question for years. What is the Denver?
Yeah. What's the next city that's going to get a cut of beef? Is it Pittsburgh?
That is a question though. Like, we've talked about this on the show before. The cuts that exist in America are because like that's how we butcher steaks, but you can get different cuts in different countries because they butcher it differently. Is there any, is there a cut that like you know about that we should be looking out for? The next Denver?
Yeah, let's get ahead of the game here.
Yeah.
If you're ever buying like whole chuck rolls yourself, and again, it's a big starting point. It's like a 20-pound chuck roll. Pull the chuck eye off and just take the first 3 steaks off of that chuck eye. The whole thing is probably like that long. Just go a little bit from the beginning. That is going to be basically the personification of ribeye flavor right there.
This is the information we need. This is the information we need.
But most people will never get the chuck eye.
No.
I think you should. Realistically, but they don't know. If you've got you know, a semi-decent knife at home and you eat a good amount of beef, I think get the chuck roll, because you can pull off the chuck eye. You can cut those into steaks. You can, the Zabuton, thank you very much, comes from the chuck roll. You can pull that guy off from the Zabuton. You can cut your cute little Denver steaks. And then the rest of it you can do as like a stew or a pot roast. So there's like, you can utilize the chuck roll in a bunch of different ways at, I think, a super cost-effective point.
How do we rename the chuck roll? Let's rename the chuck roll right now.
Oh. Where does the chuck roll come from? Where are we talking about here? On the neck. It's right here.
Doing lots. Okay. So let's come up with a city. Region.
A city. Oh, man.
This area is here. It seems to be like the North Midwest region of the animal.
Northwest region?
North Dakota. What is it called? Like the Minnesota corridor, the Michigan-Minnesota corridor. This is like the Minneapolis cut. The Ann Arbor. This is the Ann Arbor.
The right Toledo here. Cut.
The Toledo. Oh, I like a Toledo steak.
It's not Toledo cut. That's not what we're going to market it as.
All right. I would buy the hell out of a Toledo steak. That sounds good. Amazing. Is my local butcher going to be mad if I come in and I say, the Dave Chang Show told me to cut off the, take the chuck eye and cut the first
can
three
I get
steaks
the Toledo,
off?
Can
yeah,
I get the
yeah,
Toledo
they
cut?
Absolutely would.
They
would
be really annoyed, right? If I specifically go and say like, pull the chuck eye out of the chuck roll, give me the first 3 steaks off it.
Because you're basically saying out of this 20-pound piece, I only want 1 pound. Have fun moving the rest of the 19
It's like going
pounds.
To the store and be like, just give me the lifter off of those 4 ribeyes.
Can I just have the spinalis dorsi? That's another person that just got into food for the first time.
Can I have the spinalis dorsi guy? Yeah, I hate that guy too.
Well, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Man,
a first fun. Ever primal source.
Primary source, but also primal because it's beef.
Yeah.
I love this. This is great.
Thanks, Katie.
Cool. All right. Funny. Yeah. No, good talking. Let me know if you ever want to talk again.
Well, we will. For sure. Trust me.
We got more meat questions.
You just got yourself a virus that you're not getting rid of.
Thanks for me.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Talk later.
All right. Thank you, Katie. Check out Flannery Beef. They are some of the best beef butcher providers anywhere. And Katie is extremely knowledgeable. Give us 5 stars and check out Dinner Time Live. Thank you to our Pittsburgh producer, Corey. Shout out Joe Magnaniello.
Nicole Byer.
And Chris Yang, who's got to do some ad reads right now.
Oh, God, is that true?
Sucker.